Bhagavatam, Canto 5. Today we're going to go through Chapter 17, The Descent of the River Ganges. We'll see what happens. Here's the text up here for you to follow along. You can follow along the books too. So we've been introduced to Jambudvipa already. Into the varshas. We had a detailed view of Ilavritta Varsha in the Tapa Sumeru. What was going on up there? Of course, we've already discussed some issues. Why yesterday we went through these discussions in Vrindavan in July. We're showing pictures to Prabhupada. He's all thinking about going to Los Angeles. Prabhupada was explaining. It's interesting to see. Okay. So now we take this river. You'll notice, by the way, it starts talking about the outside waters, how this first verse says how Vamana Dev appeared, Bali Maharaj, from his left foot, his second step, the broke a hole into the covering of the universe with the nail of his big toe, and the pure waters of the causal ocean entered this universe. So Prabhupada says everywhere the Ganga River, Ganges River. It's just kind of interesting that actually Baya Jaladhara, if you go through this, you find that in the Sanskrit the name Ganges doesn't show up. And it doesn't really apply, and Ganges doesn't really apply until it gets into Bhart Varsha. Until then, the word that's used here is Bhagavat Padi. The water is from the Bhagavat Padi. I just thought you should. Just sort of interesting, like that. So you got this gigantic river coming down through the universe. And
I'm just wondering what the word Ganga actually means then.
Oh, I can find out. Ganga, yeah, okay, let's see. Yeah, right here, right at hand, but the Ganga has many names. It should be up here, right? Down. No, it shouldn't.
It's G-A-N-A-G-A.
G-A. Did I get the wrong N there?
Yeah,
I got the wrong N, huh? Okay. I need this N, yeah. There we go. There's something to do with going, huh? It's down here. Why can't I find it? Ganganam, Ganga. Gangana, Ga.
Oh, it's
Ganga on the right, from the beginning. It's kind of just see the bottom. Yeah, the bottom. Ganga. Yeah, Ganga. No, it's not there. Ganga, right? Ganga, swift goer. This is Mona Williams, personified and considered as the eldest daughter of Kimabat and Mena. But when it divides into four on Meru, the southern branch is the Alakananda, and that's what it's called as it goes through the southern Varshas. And there's a river, and that's where Bhadarikashram is supposed to be, on the west bank of Alakananda, which is the Ganga before it really descends into the plain. Anyway, that's what it means. You've learned something today. Ganga. Swift goer.
There's also Ganga in the sky.
Yeah, the Akasha Ganga.
One below the earth.
That's what they say. Oh, yeah, well, that's what they say here. Vyoma Ganga, Akasha Ganga. This is why I need that guy. Where's Radhe Shyam? You're supposed to give me this Puranic dictionary there. They change things around. Okay. That's why we don't have some people here today. Okay. Anyway, that's just.
Does it go in the subterranean heavenly forest too?
It does not mention here in this Bhagavatam. It doesn't mention what happens. Although Prabhupada says in another place, I don't know where, it flows on all the planets. But I don't know if it just means everything coming down. You see, I mean, we are checking all the Puranas. And he said this with Mona Williams says, so there must be some text where it says it, yeah. But there's a subterranean Ganga. But we'll see. We'll see. This is a work in progress. So here he says, so I'm just, you read this, it says, in the universe of the Ganges River, that's really not in the Sanskrit, although it, you know, it's fine. And so then how everyone can become pure by touching the waters of the Ganga, because she's known as Vishnu Padi. Actually, the text says Bhagavat Padi. Prabhupada says Vishnu Padi. This is Prabhupada's edition. Later, she receives other names like Janavi and Bhagarati, and so on. After 1,000 millenniums, the waters descend on Dhruvanoka. Now, in the introduction to this chapter, Prabhupada says that for this duration, the water remained on the head of Lord Shiva. It doesn't really say it in the Sanskrit here, but it does say 1,000 millennium passes before it. I guess that's a millennium here means Yuga cycle, I mean a whole cycle of Yugas. I don't know. And so Dhruvaloka is then Vishnupad, situated on the Vishnu's lotus feet. So then it goes to Dhruvaloka. And then Prabhupada talks about India, how it's glorious because of Ganga, Jamuna, Godavari, Kaveri, Krishna, Narmada. And so on. Now,
these other rivers, they also have their counterparts in the script Narmada.
Some do, yeah. They also flow in other places. It's not mentioned in here, but other Puranas say this. Or Prabhupada says somewhere in the purport that they flow somewhere else. And then it describes a little bit about Dhruvaloka. It says here that he's worshipping, Dhruvaloka is worshipping, is interesting, Asmat Kula Devata, our family deity. Kula Devata is our traditional family deity. Shukadeva Goswami speaking here. Worshipping our family deity. So remember, this is Uttanapada. Remember, we're really this whole chapter is a kind of digression. This whole thing of the Srimad Bhagavatam is digression from telling the story of the descendants of Swayambhu Muni, Uttanapada, and then we heard the whole story about Dhruva, and now we're on to his other son, and to Priyavrata and his sons. That's how we got into this, right? So then it describes the ecstatic manifestations on the body of Dhruva as he also accepts the water on his head with great devotion. So it comes down, and Prabhupada just remarks that Mahaprabhu had these symptoms of ecstasy. Then it goes down further to the Saptarshis, the seven rishis. There are seven sages who live on the planets just below Dhruvaloka. They're close to the pole star. There are more about that later on in the Shishumara constellation. And they keep the Gandhi water on the tufts of their, means they have also matted locks. When you are a sage and you don't take care of your body, you can do two things with your hair. You can shave it all off, or you can just let it grow without cutting the hair. It turns into dreadlocks. And so Shiva has these dreadlocks, and actually Narada Muni does too. He describes several places in the Bhagavatam as having this matted hair. Although we always show him shaved up to look like an ISKCON devotee. But anyway, so you can see that. What's the matter, guys? Cut this out.
It'll probably
come back. Oh, the power went out. Okay, let me know. Okay, so. So they take this Ganga on their heads also. So notice it's going on Lord Shiva's head and Dhruva's head, and the heads of the Saptarshis, it comes down. And then Prabhupada has a very long purport. I know this is later on, really long, but he talks about how, like Dhruva, one has to take, he says that the Saptarshis are also devotees, one has to take to that process. So thereupon, after purifying the seven planets near Dhruva, the Ganga water is carried to spaceways. And here it just says the water, that water. Through the spaceways of the demigods in billions of celestial airplanes. Then it inundates the moon, Chandraloka, and finally reaches Lord Brahma's abode atop Mount Meru. I always thought of this, you know, these tankers carrying the Ganga through the Devayani. It goes down the Devayani, you know, the pathway. There's the Pitrayani and the Devayani. This is the way you go up. And so the Ganga flows down that. But here it says it's being carried by airplanes. And I've always been enchanted by that because I thought of these kind of like truckers go picking it up and carrying it down, dumping it off, going back around again, and so on. But when you look at the Sanskrit, it says, really what it says is a gigantic long compound. So thereafter, and reading the compound, it says it descends by means of the Devayani, which is congested with squadrons of Vimanas, hundreds of thousands of Vimanas. It's just crowded. It actually doesn't say explicitly that they're being carried. The way it reads is the usual way of reading this is that it just goes down the Devayani, which is already crowded with lots of vimanas. Prabhupada, however, says they carry it. I had somebody check, and the commentators all seem to read this as simply saying that the water goes down the Devayana, which is congested with vimanas. None of them explicit say that the water is carried in the vimanas. So I don't know where Prabhupada... Usually, you know, if you see something like that, it's in the commentators. In this case, it's not. So I'm just curious as to where Prabhupada got this from. It's just something we have to research. But he talks about it quite a bit. I mean, because he then makes his point that we see celestial airplanes carry the water from the planets of the sages to other planets. So here it sounds like there's a whole like distribution system going on. So then he wants to talk about people trying to go to the moon and not being able to make it, but here, you know, people are already traveling around and so on. So that's another research point to see where this idea that the airplanes carry it. Anyways, it's the Devayana that the Ganga goes down one way or another. When it gets to the moon, which is here called Indu Mandala, it falls onto the moon, and then it says, from there it goes to the top of Meru. How it gets from the moon to Meru, I don't know. Maybe there's some other explanation, but apparently we don't see it, of course. And the moon doesn't seem to be directly above Meru. So,
I have a question about that concept of flying down, because it says it comes down to Dhruvaloka, then to the Saptarishis, then to Brahmaloka. Uh-huh. Somehow or another, I always had this idea that Brahmaloka was the highest planet in the universe, and everything else is kind of below that.
Yeah. Well, what it is it's talking about on top of Meru. It's already been described. On top of Meru, Brahma has a, Prabhupada calls it a summer house. So it's almost like it's a microcosm, because in the middle is a city of Brahma, which is, I think it's 10,000 yojana square. I don't remember. And then all around there are 8 other cities, starting with Kubera and Indra in the east, which is the Lokapalas, the 8 Lokapalas. So they are, at the top of Meru, Brahma has a city. And so when it says it falls right in the middle of his city. And there, see, I see us making a fountain. You know, like with this in the middle, and maybe we can show the Ganga coming down like using light, but then you have water and then it divides into 4 and then it falls down and is distributed, you know. But it actually, in Brahmapura, I forgot the name of the city, there's a special name for that city.
Shatakumbhi.
Huh? Shatakumbhi. Shatakumbhi, the city of Brahma there, the Shatakumbhi city, it divides. It's like you can imagine the center square is where it comes down, and then it goes off in 4 directions. And then that's what it says. On the top of Mount Meru there, into four branches. It's divided into four, with four names going in the four directions. It flows, gushes, Prabhupada says. It's in these four directions to the ocean. And we're in this, and then they gives the name Sita, Alakananda, Chakshu, and Bhadra. Those are the names. And then it describes, we still don't have power now. Okay. Yeah, so then it describes, that now we follow these, because this is the descent of the Ganges, now we follow first the eastern branch. Remember, every time you start with the east and you go around clockwise. So here we start with the eastern branch, which is called Sita. And it falls on the Keshara, Achala, and other great mountains from the top. And then this is the one going east, so then it goes, falls, ada, ada, down and down, flowing down and down. So notice it follows first on these Keshara, Achala mountains, which we discussed already, the filament mountains. Keshara is a filament. Which are almost as high as Mount Meru. And in Sadhguru's illustration, he's left them out. But in the previous chapter, there's 20 mountains and their names are given, and they're very tall. They will go almost up to Meru. And that's where they fall down onto those mountains. Remember we saw the picture of the lotus, how the stamens go around the central Karikar, these mountains. So it falls on those mountains first, and from there on to Gandhamarana. But now you can understand, you can see from this diagram here, Gandhamarana, that's the one on the right, it's they're really close to the top of Mount Meru. There's only a yojana's difference. So somehow those filament mountains are in there, we don't know how yet, how they're clumped together. They're very skinny and very tall. They fall under Madana. And then it flows. Now, hear this word pracham. Prabhupada says in the Western, that's like something that should have been corrected. Pracham is, the word is Eastern. Actually, it's not Western. It follows the east direction because it's going to Bhadrashva, which is the eastern side, right? So then that goes down and hits the saltwater ocean, right? It runs down to the nearby peaks of the Keshara-Achala mountains, which stand almost as high as Mount Meru itself. These mountains are like a bunch of filaments around Mount Meru, Prabhupada writes. Details are not in the text. Usually Prabhupada, then they're in the purport. They're almost as high as Mount Meru itself, and they're like the filaments. And I put a pop-up note here. Yeah, in chapter 16, verse 20, the 20 mountains are mentioned. So they're beautifully arranged around the base of Meru. Mona Williams, this word Keshara is like a hair of an eyebrow, the filament of a lotus or any vegetable. And then Mona Williams mentions Keshara-Achala. The filament mountains, name of the mountains situated around Meru, which is called the seed vessel of the earth. And then they actually quote this text, recites this text, and Bhagavad Purana 7, the very text we're reading is in the dictionary. But here, I don't know where, we have to see this, Meru is called the seed vessel of the earth. Here's another question that comes up to me. The lotus that Brahma is sitting on, is that what later becomes Bhumandala? And because it's out of that lotus, that's out of the lotus and the stem that he gets all the, just word, the seed vessel of the earth, you know, I mean, what's in there? So there's more to be found out about this. Because Brahma, remember, in the beginning there's a lotus. He's sitting on the lotus and performing his sacrifice, his meditation. For what is it, 1,000 years of the gods? 10,000? You figured out how much it was in his time, right?
1/36th of a second.
1/36th of a second of Brahma's time. anyway, that's a.
And he also goes down the stem as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. He climbs down the stem and gets somewhat close to Garbhodakshayi Vishnu and then comes back again, sits on it. Then he does his meditation. First he tries to figure out where he is. He hears tapa, tapa. He looks for the source of the sound. He can't find it. He performs penance and austerity. Then he's impregnated with the Vedas and he makes the earth as it makes the universe as it was before. And he uses as the ingredients the what's in the lotus and the stem, which is really a body part of Vishnu. I'm just noticing things we need to investigate whether this is this where he has, because his city's right on the top of this lotus, you know, I mean, and it goes down underneath. And I think some accounts have it going down further than all the way down to the bottom, so I don't know. We'll see.
Does the stem have a dimension?
I don't know. Gotta find out.
Yeah, because it gives dimensions for the universe, right? But if the universe, when everything in the universe is supposed to be within the stem.
Well, originally he takes it out. I think he somehow makes it manifest outside of it. That's my understanding. But part of this thing I think we need to do is look at that whole story of Visarga. And try to figure out a more detailed and related to this part of it too. But it just raised that question, probably. It's just really interesting when you start looking at these things closely, all the things that come up. Now we go to the west. With a chakshu on the Malayavan mountain, and from there cascades from the Ketumala Varsha. I don't know if you remember the diagram. Yeah. And then to Ketumala, remember on the east and west, there's only one Varsha flanking Ilavritta. North and south, there's three. So it just falls on this one mountain range, the boundary mountain, which is called Malayavan Mountain, and then goes down and flows to the sea. Now it gets a little interesting because now we go to the north. With the northern branch of this river is called Bhadra. And what it says, proper translate in the translation it says, the branch of the Ganges known as Bhadra flows from the northern side of Mount Meru. Its waters fall into the peak of Kumuda Mountain. That's the first boundary mountain, Mount Nila, Sweta, Sringavan in succession. It falls onto the peaks in succession. Then it runs down in the province of Kuru, that's the northernmost Varsha, and after crossing through that land, throws in the salt water ocean in the north. Now, you look at what Prabhupada, what it says in the word for word, Atihaya. And Prabhupada translates this as passing over as if not touching. Skipping. Atihaya means to jump over, to pass, jumping from one place to another. And this word in the text refers to all three northern mountain ranges. So what, and when he says passing over as if not touching, all I can think is it must like, because it, as if not touching sort of says it comes really close or something. And Vidna Chakravarti Thakur says this river skips over the first three varshas. It doesn't hit Ilavritta, Ramyaka, and Aranmaya. It doesn't go to ground until it hits Kuru Varsha. So it arches over. It arches over. And somehow or other, either flies over the mountains or bounces off of them or something like that. You imagine the water may scoop out a little depression and just go like a chute, you know, go back up again. It flies over the mountains. That's what it says. And it seems a similar thing happens going south. I mean, that's a lot of water. And the interior varshas are dry. Tata eva, similarly, the Alakananda on the southern side from Brahmapuri, it hits the top of many mountains. And then he mentions, and Atikrama means crossing over. Again, that's the word, Atikrama. It crosses over. Hemakuta, that's the next boundary mountain, is Hemakuta. And then he says, Haimakutani, this is in the plural. I don't know what this refers to. Haimakutani means literally snow-covered peaks. The Prabhupada says here the Himakuta, but I don't know what mountain that is. And it mentions here it's going very, very fiercely. And then passing over the tops of the mountains in various lands. So I was wondering, well, exactly what that meant. How does it pass over the tops? But it basically flies over the tops, you know. And I don't know what the Himakuta mountain is. And then it falls into Bhardvarsha. And he says inundating the tops of these mountains. So again, it sounds like the tops get a little wet, nothing else. Okay, and then persons who come to bathe in this river are fortunate. Then now it's now here. But again, the text just refers, is we're still talking about the Alakananda. And you get, because of this, by just bathing in this river, achieve the results of performing Rajasuya Ashwamedha Yaga Yajna. And Prabhupada talks about various places, the Ganga Sagara and Prayag for the Kumbh Mela in January and so on. Then he mentions that there are many other rivers, big and small, that are like the daughters of Meru and the other mountains that that flow to the various tracts of lands and hundreds of branches. Just doesn't say any more about this. I suppose we'll find out all about that in detail from somewhere else. So that's we followed the rivers up, and we've seen where they go. Now the topic switches a little bit, and now we have three verses discussing Bhauma Swarga. There's nine varshas in Jambudvip. Bhart Varsha is called the field of fruitive activity. The Sanskrit is Karma Kshetra, right here. It's Karma Kshetra. Whereas the other eight varshas are the places where here he calls them Bhomani Swarga Padani. Swarga, heaven on earth. The other eight, where they're for highly elevated pious people, the Swarginam, the living entities elevated to the heavenly planets, where it says Punya Shesha Upaboga Stanani, the place where they enjoy the tail end, the remainder of their punya. So Prabhupada translates this, after returning, they go to the heavenly planets, the Swarga, and they perform, on Swarga, you do not make further spiritual advancement. You just in Karma Kshetra, you perform your punya, you go up there, and you just have a good time. It's like you're on vacation. Like you're working in some city in some dreary job in a bank or some kind of office in front of a computer, and you collect your pay, and so much you put it into a bank account, and then you go on holiday, and you've got enough money. And you go to some nice place in India. They like to go to Mauritius right now. We have the Caribbean, and in Europe they go down to the Canary Islands or places like that. Everybody's got their heaven on earth that they go to. And when you're there, you just spend money. You've got your traveler's checks or your savings, and you spend money. And then when the money runs out, you come back to your office job, right? You can't stay there once your money's all gone. So similarly, your pious credit is a fixed as a deposit, which you then draw upon while you're up there. And then it says here there's a transition to make it easy on you, that when you get toward the end, you go down to these eight earthly varshas, and there you enjoy the tail end of your pious activities. That's what's happening there, right? And so here Prabhupada uses the terms at the end of this purport, which is a long purport because he talks about many other things. Here you see the words, the three divisions. The purport is about how we're not interested in these places. We'll see after we get the description how interested we may be. Divya Swarga, in other words, where the devas live, the heavenly Swarga is called Divya Swarga, where the gods are. Bhauma Swarga, what we're talking about now. And then the later chapter, Bila Swarga. Bila means a hole. Prabhupada calls it the subterranean. under the Bhumandala Swarga, these Swarga heavens. I told you the root meaning of Swarga is wide open spaces, but here we're using the sense of places of superior sensual enjoyment. I mean, even in English, the word heaven means skies, but now it comes to mean, you know, a place you go to have a good time, right? We talk about heaven this way. Interesting. This is one of these places where it seems like Prabhupada said, of the three divisions of heavenly planets, Swargaloka, Bhoma Swarga is sometimes accepted as the tract of land in Bharatvarsha known as Kashmir. This is one of these places where he almost uses this as he takes Jambudweep as Sataputta also says, a map of India and the areas north and east of it, because here Kashmir is mentioned as Bhoma Swarga. At any rate, in this region, the Prabhupada has a long purport about Brahmins and what they're supposed to do. You're wandering through the universe, you meet a guru, you have your chance of going back to Godhead, and how a guru is better than a brahmana. It describes the activities of a brahmana. And then, but the ultimate point is we should not be interested in these swargas. So now we have a description. In these eight varshas, human beings live 10,000 years according to earthly calculations. That's exactly what it says. And the inhabitants are almost like demigods. The word here, you can see up there, is deva kalpana. It's in the plural. So deva kalpa. In Sanskrit, the word kalpa as a suffix, IFC is jargon for infinal composition. And it shows up at the end of the word. That's what that IFC means. So it's stuck onto something having the manner or form of anything similar to, resembling, like, but with a degree of inferiority, almost. So they're like, almost like gods, or sort of like gods, like that. They live 10,000 years. They have the bodily strength of 10,000 elephants. Their bodies are sturdy as thunderbolts. The youthful duration of their lives is very pleasing. In other words, they don't grow old. Both men and women enjoy sexual union with great pleasure for a long time. After years of sensual pleasure, when a balance of 1 year of life remains, the wife conceives a child. Thus, the standard of pleasure for the residents of the heavenly regions is exactly like that of the human beings who live during Treta Yuga. There's an interesting purport here. Such Yuga, people were so absorbed, no one was interested in materials and sense enjoyment. During Treta Yuga, people enjoyed sense pleasure without tribulation. It's without difficulty. So Treta Yuga, such yuga is no one's interested. So that's why it says Treta Yuga. Treta Yuga, you enjoy sense pleasure, but without any inconvenience. Material miseries begin in Dwarpa Yuga. But they were not very stringent. Some did inconvenience, but not terrible. Stringent like very strong material miseries really began from the advent of Kali Yuga. So that's the difference. Another point in this verse is that in all eight of these heavenly varshas, although men and women enjoy sex pleasure, there is no pregnancy. Pregnancy takes place only in like lower grade life. Then dogs and hogs pregnant twice a year, and they have litters, you know, lots of things. Snakes give birth to hundreds of young at one time. So that in grades of life higher than ours, pregnancy occurs once in a lifetime. People still have sex life, but there's no pregnancy. Then this is very interesting. In the spiritual world, people are not very attracted to sex life due to their exalted devotional attitude. Practically speaking, there is no sex life in the spiritual world. But even if sometimes it does occur, there's no pregnancy at all. People have asked me all throughout my devotional career about this sex life, and of all the things to be interested in. But apparently, once in a while, something happens. Anyway, and then he talks about here we have pregnancy occurs and people are using sinful means of killing children in the womb to avoid the consequence. They want to live like people in the higher planets, but unfortunately you cannot do so when you try. It's sinful. Do you have a question?
Verse 11. It mentions that when lust, that it says that several are divided into three parts. So, Devisarga, Gomasarga, and Vilasarga.
Yes.
So, Devisarga, that the animals are staying there.
Devisarga.
They're entering there, they cannot make further future. When I come to this
world, yes, that's right.
Come, Jaka. Mm-hmm. And he
said, Bhoma Sarva, is it in Kashmir? No, he says some people call Kashmir Bhoma.
What is this in Vilasarga?
Vilasarga means, there's another chapter coming called Vilasarga. Atala, Sutala, Tatala, below, where the demons live. And each one is described and who's there, beginning with the one with Maya Dhanava. What chapter number is it?
It's
54. Yeah, 24. So that's all described. This Vilasarga and what goes on there. And at the bottom of the Nagas. So light there. And there's no sunlight because it's all blocked by Bhumandala. Yeah, so that's the one down there.
Only the jewels, snakes are there.
Huh?
Some jewels are there with the light.
Yeah, the snakes have jewels in their head, and that's how you read or you have snake light.
I've never seen a jewel. Doesn't jewel give light in the dark by itself?
Usually, the jewels we see reflect light. But everywhere, many times you see that the jewels have the property of giving light. So I don't know what jewels they are, they're not the ones that I see, they reflect light. But these apparently are light-emitting diode jewels, LED jewels or something. Yeah. And so, in other words, so the if you're living in these places, the light comes up from the bottom, where all the Nagas are. But as we'll see, down with those Nagas is Anantashesha, who is in fact served by the Naga princesses in conjugal rasa. That's an interesting part. Nagas are very interesting. We'll get to that. Okay, so now we're up here with these people who have this standard of living where they have all, they're almost like demigods. They have all this facility for material enjoyment. And now a further description. Gardens of flowers and fruits and decorated hermitages, and between the great mountains on the borders are lakes of clear water with newly grown lotus flowers, the various birds and bumblebees, the sound of the bumblebees. The inhabitants of these lands are important leaders among the demigods. I don't understand this exactly, because it sounds like they're all like kind of Upa, we've heard earlier, Upadevas. But here it mentions important leaders. As I said, the important leaders seem to visit. When it talks about it here, they call Devapati, the lords of the demigods, such as Indra, he says. So we know they have vacation homes down there. Maybe that's what they're found down there. Always attended by their respective servants. He says, because it says here in the Sanskrit, you see that in those eight tracts of lands, you find devapatis, devapati in plural, devapatayaha, swanai, sanai, gana, nayaki, with they're followed by their all their retinue of servants and aides and stuff like that. They're found there. But it seems to me what that probably means is these are vacation spots for them, especially on Mount Mandara. There's this Mani Parvata, which is was stolen by Bulmasura, the big playground for the devas, all the devas. They enjoy life in gardens alongside the lakes. In this pleasing situation, the wives of the demigods smile playfully at their husbands and look upon them with lusty desires. All the demigods and their wives are constantly supplied with sandalwood pulp and flower garlands by their servants. In this way, all the residents of the eight heavenly varshas enjoy, attracted by the activities of the opposite sex. Here is a description of the lower heavenly planets. Here Prabhupada calls them the lower heavenly planets. So he talks about again how it's nice. In this, that atmosphere, they enjoy life with their very beautiful wives who are always sexually stimulated. Nonetheless, they are all devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as will be explained in subsequent verses. The inhabitants of this earth also desire such heavenly enjoyment, but when they somehow or other achieve imitation pleasures like sex and intoxication, they completely forget the service of the Supreme Lord. In the heavenly planets, however, although the residents enjoy superior sense gratification, they never forget their positions as eternal servants of the Supreme Being. Now, how many devotees do I know that this is really what they want?
Prabhupada famously wrote in a letter, there'll be another ISKCON in the spiritual sky. It's going to be an even bigger one. Because I know so many people that really what they want is they want to be devotees and worship Krishna and not forget him, and also enjoy superior sense gratification. Unfortunately, when you try to do that here, it wipes out your Krishna consciousness, you know. So, but here you can have it both ways. How this works, I have no idea. Because actually the sense pleasure that we have here is very crude and very gross. And their sense pleasure is very refined, although it's sex and sex desire and everything else. It's really quite refined. And a superior quality that is much more pleasing than what we have here. That was what I said. But it really, that's the situation. But tells it like it is. But he keeps warning us in these purports, we should not want to go there. And the Bhagavad Gita says, you get enchanted by these descriptions. And you go there, the flowery words of the Vedas describe all these things. You know, you think, because then, you know, you come back down again, and you go through that. Okay, so
is
that's
what it means when it says the fallen yogis, they go to the planets of the pious living beings, and then again they take birth in an auspicious
way. Yeah. Well, it depends. The ones that are not that, just a little advanced, they go up to here, they enjoy deva bhogan, the sense gratifications of the gods, and then they come back down and they take a good birth on earth. Those who are more advanced, they go straight to a family of great devotees. Right, that's what it says in the sixth chapter. So there's two groups really. After a short practice, then although you fail, whatever you did counts as at least a lot of punya. And so you go to the heavenly planets. Because you still have many of your material desires. If your material desires are practically gone, but still you don't have enough to get out, you don't go to the heavenly planets. You go straight to a family of yogis. Prabhupada mentions, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, you were born like this. For example, that kind of birth. I think he mentions it.
So, as you mentioned, that they go straight to the related family. You said those who have good result in their action, in their having a talent, they can go directly to the devotee's house.
No. It doesn't say. What the Bhagavad Gita says, I didn't bring my Bhagavad Gita, but I assume I have it with, I can get it up on here. Is it in here? Huh? Yeah, the Bhagavad Gita. But the Bhagavad Gita says there's two groups. It says two groups. One group, after short practice, they go to the heavenly planets, come back, Suchinam Srimatam Gehe, in the home of either the pure people or Srimad Switch people. So there you have a chance for further advancement, but not so secure. Then the next group, who are longer advanced, they take birth in the family of Goswamis, Prabhupada says in the purport. In a Goswami family. Then he mentions that today the Goswamis are very degraded.
Yeah, the question is here.
Huh?
Those are coming the Goswami families. From that family, some bad sons are also coming out. And
the what?
The Goswami families.
Yeah.
Some people know that they are very bad, but their family is very nice. The son is doing very well. A very bad and very good family there.
Uh-huh.
Sons are very bad.
Uh-huh.
But there is another place that very bad community, sons are coming very good. How?
We don't know the whole past of people, how this happens.
They said that those who are less practiced, they will get evil something.
Yeah, but sometimes what somebody has the name Goswami, there's some good people, but already they're not like they used to be. You know, they're not like they used to be. And anyway, everywhere you look, you sometimes see from a bad family a good person comes, and from a good family a bad person comes. So this happens sometimes. You can't tell. Prahlad Maharaj, born from the demons. Right?
I asked Prabhupada a question on this one. Because I said, you know, this, you can only become a devotee according to natural devotion if you've done devotional service in previous lives. Yeah. And then I said, and according to the Gita, you know, if you don't complete it, then you get one of these auspicious births. Mm-hmm. But I said, you know, I've said now or another, I've become a devotee, but I don't have any of these, mm-hmm. you know, material influences. I was born in a, you know, kind of a low grade family of diseases, and we're not, you know, by any means rich, and all these, you know, so none of these attributes mm-hmm. are there. So I said, how does that work? So then Prabhupada said, he said, it's not that the devotee becomes degraded by the family that he takes birth in. The family becomes elevated by the appearance of the devotee within them. And then he says, just like Prahlad
Maharaj. Someplace he compared his disciples to Prahlad Maharaj. They all came out of demon families. Okay, thank you.
Okay, now... So that's the end of that topic. Now we return to, now the topic changes, the subject change. Now having talked about those nine varshas, he says in text 14, to show mercy to his devotees in each of these nine tracts of land, the Supreme Personality of Godhead known as Narayan, Bhagavan Narayana Mahapurusha expands himself into his quadruple principles of Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Parjuna, and Aniruddha. This Atmatattva Vyuhina
expands his self into the Vyuha. So the Vyuha means the usual expansion of the Chatur Vyuha. Of these Vasudev, Shankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha, in this way he remains near his devotees to accept their service.
Now, here we see, we're going to now, this is introducing the topic of how in each varsha a form of the Lord is worshipped by a great devotee, and the prayers are there. So these are talking about deity forms. And here Prabhupada says, which is quoting Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, that the demigods worship the Supreme Lord in his deity form because, except in the spiritual world, the Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot be directly worshipped in person. In the material world, the Lord is always worshipped as the Arja Vigraha, or deity in the temple. So these referring to now, these worship that takes place, they're all worshiping a murti, or javigraha.
Then he quotes from the Laghu Bhagavatamrita to the effect that that in the spiritual world, in four directions, the Lord is Vasudeva, Shankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha. And then the same is represented by the deity in the material world. And they're present in the four directions of this material world. Then Prabhupada mentions here, he's still quoting the text. There's a Vaikuntha Loka covered with water in the material world. And on that planet is a place called Vedavati, where Vasudev is located. Another planet known as Vishnu Loka is situated above such a loka, and there Sankarshan is present. Similarly, in Dwarkapuri, Prajumna is the predominator. And on the island on the Swetha Deep, there's an ocean of milk. And in the midst of that ocean is a place called Airavatipura, where Aniruddha lies on Ananta. It's kind of interesting. That's something I like to investigate further. He also quotes the same
or refers to the same passage in the Lagu Bhagavatamrita there. One interesting thing is above this Vishnu Loka, above Satya Loka, with Shankarshan, you'll see that we have Shankarshan on the whole axis going straight down. In other words, at the top, now around Mount Meru, where Shiva and Ilavrita Varshas work with Shankarshan, and then down at the bottom, his expansion of Ananta is there. So that he's in these, and then also in other different directions. And then he mentions the sub of the Satvata Tantra. Satvata means Vaishnava. A description of the nine Varshas, where they give this up, this list of nine forms of the Lord. It's a little different from the account in the Bhagavatam, where Brahma, here's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, after that little introduction, we turn to Ilavritte in Ilavritta Varsha. The only male person is Lord Shiva. Eka Eva Pumman Nahi Anya. He is in fact the only male, and there is no other. Besides him, no other enters there. And the cause is the curse by Bhavani. He's called here Bhavani, excuse me, not Bhavani. Bhavani, the Lord Shiva's wife. You always pronounce, mispronounce that name in this God, it's Bhavani. He probably calls her Durga. Who does not like any man to enter the land. It's the curse, her curse, but actually it's Lord Shiva's curse. If any foolish man dares to do so, she immediately turns him into a woman. I shall explain this later in the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a very enchanting story, which I've got a little summary in this pop-up. Shraddhadev, who is the present Manu, Vaivasvata Manu, his personal name is Shraddhadev, his firstborn child was a girl named Ila. Now his priest Vasishta was performing a sacrifice. He had no children, so he had Vasishta perform a sacrifice. Naturally, he wanted a son. His wife, whose name is Shraddha, wanted a girl. And she made this known to one of the priests, not Vasishta, but one of the Hotra. And so the Hotra fiddled with the mantra. And this girl was born named Ila. And then Shraddhadev was very upset and said to Vasishta, you know, what did you do? I asked for a son and now... And so Vasishta figured out what was going on and he turned Ila into a beautiful boy named Sudyumna. So now the story is that Sudyumna with some companions went hunting. They were on horseback. And it says, and this is all in the ninth canto, he entered a forest in the north at the base of Meru. And the name of the forest is Sukumara. This is the place where Shiva enjoys intimately with Uma, Bhavani, Durga. So earlier, some great sages from Bhadarika Ashram had come to the forest to worship the Lord, and they came upon Shiva and Uma at a wrong time. And Uma, she was sitting on Shiva's lap without any clothes. She had no clothes on. She was really embarrassed by these sages. The sages realized, oh, no, they just turned and went back. We didn't mean to intrude. So Shiva, to satisfy her, to assuage her mortification, he made it so that henceforth, any male who enter this Sukumara Van, Vana, this forest, would be transformed into female.
So Sudyumna and his companions, when they crossed the border into that forest, they found themselves all women, and their stallions turned into mares. So that's the story. The story goes on. It's a really fun story. In this day of transgendered persons and so many things, it's very interesting to us. So Sudyumna is in this situation, and he is now a very beautiful girl, and he's wandering around and he lives with Varsha, and he runs across the ashram, he comes across by the ashram of Buddha, the son of Mangala. Buddha is the god of Mercury. Not with two D's like Deep Love Lord Buddha, Buddha and Deep Buddha. And he really falls in love with her. And so they get married, and she actually has a son. But still, she's not really satisfied or something. So Vashishta sees that here's a person that he changed into a man is now back into being a woman again. So he calls upon Lord Shiva to help. And so the best they could do is 1 month a man, 1 month a woman. He goes back and forth.
Some karma, huh?
Yeah, really. And he was a king, but apparently the month he was a woman, he couldn't act as a king. So this was not a regular arrangement for the citizens. They were always like a little distressed. But he had a number of sons and so on. I guess as a man, because they. Well, that's a story. It's
one of the great Bhagavatam stories. I have to write it up. People like this one. So anyway, that's why in Vritta Varsha, as a rule, there's only one man. I say as a general rule because we also know in Vritta Varsha are these places where, in Mandara Mountain, that Hiranyakashipu performed austerities. Another person that did is Agnidra. The son of Priyavrata, who was given rulership over Jambudvipa, and so he wanted to have a really powerful son, so that he could go to Pitriloka. He wanted to be transferred to Pitriloka, so he needed a good son who would offer a sacrifice powerfully. And so he went to Mandara Mountain to practice austerities and worship, because he also knew that the girls from the heaven came there for recreational purposes. And so this is all described earlier in this canto. And so Brahma sees what he wants, so he sends an apsara named Purvachiti. And so by Purvachiti, he has 9 sons. And then Purvachiti apsaras, they come, they live with you, you have a great time, they're wonderful, and then one day they're just gone. But she was still merciful to him, so she, when she left, she went to Pitriloka, so that he's still attached to her when he left, but he went to attain that destination. But her 9, then his 9 sons, Anitra's sons, they became kings of each of the Varshas, and they're named after his sons, except the one, Nag, he became the king of what's now called Bharat Varsha, because it was given that name from the son of Rishabhadev, because Nabi's son, Nabi married these 9, yeah, Meru Devi, the daughter of Meru. Meru had 9 daughters that married each of the sons of Agnidra. We have to turn it off now. So that's the story that happened. So that, and that's a, that the story about Mitra and Puruchiti is really cute, because apparently he's really innocent, and he thinks he's some kind of really nice boy, you know. He can't figure out exactly what she is.
What is the word view bothering?
Huh?
What is the word view bothering? Because it says Atma,
Tattva, view. Yeah, well, let's look it up. I can't remember now exactly what it means. Oh, I have it already open. Okay. One is enough. Is it V-H-Y?
V-Y-U.
No, V-Y, yeah, I'm saying it wrong. Vyuha. I think it means a spread or arrangement.
It comes up in the Mahabharata, Chakravyuha.
Yeah, Chakravyuha. It means...
Chakravyuha.
Vyuha. Arrangement, yeah, that's what I have. Placing up orderly arrangements of the parts of the whole disposition. A military ray is called Vyuha.
Chakravyuha.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. It just means arrangement.
Uh-huh.
And here he says, well, you can't see this, especially the quadruple form manifestation, especially the quadruple manifestation of Purushottama as Vasudeva Shankarsham, Pajumna Aniruddha. Okay? Just like formation or array. Or just the manifestation. Really crass my style here. Now you just ping up and you have noise. Irritating noise.
How are you doing better?
Oh, I'm okay. I have an extra battery in my, thing. Yeah, my battery's loaded. It's 100%. So, in Ilavritta Varsha, Shiva's encircled by 10 billion maidservants of goddess Durga. These maidservants are mentioned elsewhere as the wives of the Yakshas. They're already mentioned in here. The Punya Jana volumes. Wives of the Yakshas are called Punya Jana, pious folk. Then the quadruple expansion of the Lord is known as, and here they're mentioned as Shankarshan, Vasudeva Pradyumna Anirudha Shankarshan. So Shankarshan, the fourth expansion, is certainly transcendental, but because his activities of destruction in the material world are in the mode of ignorance, he is known as Tamasi, the Lord's form in the mode of ignorance. Lord Shiva knows that Shankarsana is the original cause of his own existence, and thus he always meditates upon him in trance by chanting the following mantra. So here we begin the worship. So it says here, he's known as Shankarsana and Tamasi, which means here, related to the mode of ignorance. Tamasim Murtim. So this will be probably explains this, but because he's involved in destruction, he's known as Tamasi. And Lord Shiva, we find out later, he's called Sankarsana with the first long A, coming from Sankarsana. But he's also in the activities of the mode of ignorance. So he always meditates upon him in trance by chanting the following mantra. Also, Prabhupada explains that Lord Shiva destroys this world. First of all, he's in meditation, and his Ishta Devata, his chosen divinity or desired divinity, is Shankarsana. That comes up many times in the Bhagavatam. Worshipping or meditating on Shankarsana. Because destruction is in the mode of ignorance, Lord Shiva and his worshipable deity, Shankarsana, are technically called Tamasi. So both of them. Lord Shiva is the incarnation of Tamoguna. Since both Lord Shiva and Shankarshan are always enlightened and situated in the transcendental position, they have nothing to do with the modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. But because their activities involve them with the mode of ignorance, they are sometimes called tamasu. So this is a delicate point for people to understand how that Lord Shiva, because he is the Lord of Tamoguna, if worshipped separately from or independently of Lord Vishnu, does not have the power to grant liberation to devotees. That restorative power is not invested in him. If you worship him as a devotee who's worshiping Shankarshan, as you know, Vaishnavanam Yatha Shambhu, he is the greatest among the Vaishnavas. That's in a verse that explains Bhagavatam as the Ganges is among rivers, as Varanasi is among cities, as Shiva is among Vaishnavas, so this Bhagavatam is among Puranas. So he's the topmost devotee. You worship him as a devotee, no problem. Worship him separately. Because of the proximity with the mode of ignorance, and remember, ultimately the whole material world is the mode of ignorance. Ignorance is there. He loses, he doesn't have that independent restorative power. Like you can worship. See, Prabhupada says something very interesting. That you see, Vishnu himself is never consorts intimately with the material nature. He's intimate with his internal potencies, his spiritual potencies. So we have Radha Krishna, we have Lakshmi Narayan, we have Sita Ram. But in every case, the Lord is with one of his manifestations of his either Radharani or Lakshmi expansions. You don't have, so, but he never is intimate with the material nature, Durga or Bhavani. You know, so Prabhupada says somewhere, he says, the Lord never consorts intimately with the material nature, but when he does, he's Lord Shiva. He takes on this different aspect because of that intimate contact. So in the Brahma Samhita, it's described that at a distance, he glances Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, or Mahavishnu rather, glances at material nature from a distance, and that glance is carries the conditioned soul. So by glancing at her a distance, he impregnates her, but that glance takes the form of Lord Shiva.
Is that Sada Shiva?
I'm just going to ask, what is Sada Shiva
famous for? Sada Shiva is a Vishnu type of deity. Sadashiva in the spiritual world is Vishnu Tattva. That's different. Sadashiva is a form of or an expansion of Mahavishnu in the spiritual world.
That's not the Shiva thing.
No. This is the one that really is in contact now with material nature. Or, you know, just Shiva has his dual aspect. This is the tricky place.
We just came back from
Hari Hara.
We were just back again. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, we were talking about it on the way back, exactly what form of Shiva is he in.
In this deity.
And who is that way, sir?
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, see, do I just describe both ways? Because as far as I understand, he's either Mahavishnu or Sadashiva.
But I think they're one's an expansion. I mean, Sadashiva is a form of Mahavishnu.
But he's not the one that impregnates.
No. That's another expansion.
What is that? Shambhu?
Yeah, Shambhu. We just call him Shiva.
And who is the Shiva that lives in, like, between the material and spiritual worlds? Who's that?
I think it's the same Shiva. And depending on which side of the line he is, he's this one or that one. But I'm not sure about that.
Because that's something we have to show.
Yeah, we have to figure that out, right. You know, I have to do a little more research on this. Yeah. Because, but the Sadashiva is definitely Vishnu. And see, when you talk about Shiva in relationship to the material world and tamasi, then he's not a jiva, but because of his position, he's not called Vishnu Tattva, and he's just assigned his own Shiva Tattva, a separate category. So in that form, he's worshipping Shankarshana. And although sometimes it's spoken as though he is in the mode of ignorance, but it's not really like that. It's just that so close, and his associates and the people around him, sometimes it's pretty. I once saw this exhibit of this touring the United States of. Shiva Murtis and paintings and everything from India touring all around these museums in America, and had these little paintings of Shiva and Parvati and Ganesh and Kartikeya. Like it's like a little family scene, and they're all sitting around, they're just stringing garlands of heads. Like reminding these Charles Adam cartoons. Because you heard them. Yeah. Anyway, let's go on. So we still don't have power, huh? It'd be nice to look at this next one with the screen.
What does Sadashiv do? It says Lord Shiva that's responsible for the destruction of the end of the desert.
Yeah. Also, Lord Shiva and also Ananta Shesha. Ananta Shesha. We're going to talk about the position of Shankarshan or his immediate expansion. When we get to this part, by the way, from 15, the narration switches from verse to prose, and then we come to the prayers. Now what we're going to see is this is Lord Shiva. When it says Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, it means Lord Shiva. And then he offers this prayer to Lord Shankarshan. He's praying to Lord Shankarshan. In each of the varshas, they offer prayers. And the first one is later on referred to as an Upanishad, a Upanishadic prayer. Because this is in prose, like the Upanishad text, although it begins with Om. And so there, in every case, there's one Upanishadic prayer, and then it's followed by various numbers of verses in slokas. So in this case, there's this Upanishadic mantra, and then there's seven
slokas of metrical prayers that follow. So now we're going to see how Lord Shiva leads. The only other people there are Bhavani and her maid servants in prayer. So here's the prayer. See, Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya Sarva Guna Shankyanayanaya. Well, this is breaking up. Sarva Guna Shankyayana Sakyayanaya Sakyanaya Arantaya Avyantaya Namaha. The word iti at the end is a quotation mark. He doesn't say iti. That's to show. In Sanskrit, the word iti functions. When you see iti, many times it means whatever's in front of it is a quotation. Thus, huh? Iti is thus. So here they say, so what he says is Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya. Sarva guna sankhyayanaya nantaya vyaktaya namaha. You have to put the visarga at the end. So they're all of this form. They begin Om Namo Bhagavate, and then there's a name of the Lord, and then these various words that describe, and they're all in the dative case. It's the dative ablative case. Om Namo Bhagavate, I'm offering my basis Namaha unto Mahapurusha. Mahapurushaya means unto Mahapurusha. Sarvaguna Sankhyayanaya. Sankhyayanaya. Sarvaguna Sankhyayana. Mean the reservoir of all transcendental qualities. So, Anantaya, also referring to the name Ananta, who is Ananta, but here the unlimited. Avyakta, not manifested within the material world, I offer my obeisances. That's the form of this prayer. You see? We should chant it. I'll try to split it up. Okay, so say after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Mahapurushaya.
Sarva Guna Sankhyanaya.
Sarva Guna Sankhyanaya.
Arantaya.
Arantaya.
Avyaktaya.
Avyaktaya.
Namaha. Our prayer. We're along with Lord Shiva and everybody and delivered to Varsha. The most powerful Lord Shiva says, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you in your expansion as Lord Shankarshan. You are the reservoir of all transcendental qualities. Although you are unlimited, you remain unmanifest to the non-devotees. This is the avyakta. Avyakta means not manifest. You can't see him. So Shankarshan, I've put some stuff here that we should know about Shankarshan, since he's so important, actually, because in a way, this section is a kind of preview of chapter 25, the glories of Lord Ananta. Some of the almost same things are said, because Ananta Dev is an expansion of Shankarshan, and so they're very close to each other. So Shankarshan is the second person in the chapter of Vyuha, and Shankarshan is the Lord of false ego. Vasudeva is in charge of what? Anybody know? Vasudeva, Shankarshan, Prajumna, Aniruddha. Vasudeva is the Lord of consciousness. Pure consciousness called Vasudeva. So he is the Lord of
He rules over consciousness, especially the consciousness of those in the material world. Right here, this Chaturiva. And then Shankarshan, the second person in the Chaturvyuha, is the lord of false ego. And then from him is Pradyumna, who is the lord of intelligence, buddhi, and then Aniruddha, who's all in charge of the mind. So when creation takes place, what you see is what's manifest, first of all, is false ego. Well, there's consciousness, which is contaminated consciousness, and false ego is manifest. And false ego is then in goodness, passion, and ignorance. From false ego and passion, buddhi is manifest and other things, the working senses. And from false ego in goodness is the mind. And then from false ego in ignorance, the Mahabhutas, sound and so on, and the tan mantras, the sense objects. That's how so the whole world comes out of false ego. And then goodness, passion, and ignorance, and then everything evolves out of that.
Since Shiva's function is to actually generate the living beings in the material world, and false ego is the point of contact of the soul with the material energy, is there a connection between that, those functions, and Shiva meditating on Shankarsha?
Yeah, exactly.
So because
of that, yeah. He meditates on Shankarsha. Because Lord Shiva is the lord of the mode of ignorance, but the whole thing is basically in the mode of ignorance. Therefore, Mahadev, he's the lord of this world, in one sense. Lord Shiva, because everybody in the material world is in Maya, avidya. It's just one degree of avidya or another.
Yeah. If the mind is born of the mode of goodness and intelligence from the mode of passion, why in the Bhagavad Gita the hierarchy of intelligence is considered higher than the mind?
Yeah, well, it's reversed. As I understand it, for a few reasons. First of all, when the mind is pure, well, it's okay. I mean, in the mode of goodness, it's all the devatas and the mind come out. Then the mode of passion had the intelligence, because intelligence has a function, just as the mind is the center of the knowledge-acquiring senses. Because the powers of the knowledge-acquiring senses also are there. Similarly, the active senses, karmendriya, for acting on the world, their backup is buddhi. In fact, buddhi helps all the senses. So because it's involved with the senses in this way, all the senses come out of the mode of passion. And the power behind that is that helps the senses work is buddhi. For example, if Kapila Dev explains that some of the things that buddhi does are just on an ordinary, everyday level, is it enables us to recognize objects, like the phenomena of recognition. is really a function of buddhi. So it plays a very close role. Without any buddhi, you're just like an idiot. So it plays this very close role with the senses, which are a product of the mode of passion. But on the other hand, the way it works is that the mind itself is the place where habit is formed. Because of buddhi, you learn to lurk. Buddhi gets instructions from an authority. Say you're a little child. So how do you know how to look at the world? But your authorities, your mother, your father. And from them, you see things in certain ways. You have certain categories, you experience things. What do you notice? What do you don't notice? What's important? What's not important? What's interesting? What's not interesting? I mean, there's so much stuff in a room right now. You couldn't possibly, but buddhi has sorted it out for us. And so that way we look at things becomes established in the mind. And the mind just goes on with this kind of habit. So in the material world, we have the habit, everyone, of sense gratification. The mind has the habit, it's the repository of all ideas of sense gratification. Whatever sense gratification is going on, the mind wants to keep it. It's just like stupid, classical, Pavlovian conditioning. You see some sense object, you want it. But when you want to become a devotee, you have to change that mind. You reprogram it. The mind is your enemy at this point. Now you have to make the mind your friend. So what does that is intelligence. But this time, intelligence is receiving direction, as we do, from the spiritual master and from the super soul. So ultimately, intelligence, when it's fixed up, Prabhupada describes it in the Bhagavatam, is the form direction of the super soul. In other words, the form in which the super soul gives us direction is through buddhi. And so its function in this way is we see the world through a whole interrelated mindset, a gestalt. If you change it and go to another one, that kind of a change happens on the platform of intelligence. You make little changes on the mental platform. That's not too big, but if like one whole way of looking at the world is somehow destroyed in another, as like, for example, the experience many of us have when we become devotees, we just had one whole way of looking at the world smashed and another whole way replaced by another. That happens on the platform of buddhi. So the way it actually works, it's more powerful because it's the way the super soul deals with it. So it's, although it's in the, evolves out of the mode of passion, it's still higher in a sense. For example, Prabhupada describes different levels of culture. He says there's the culture of the body, the culture of the mind, the culture of intelligence, and the culture of the soul. Are you familiar with this? So he says the culture of the body is invested in different places like restaurants, health spas, all the things that we do just to make the body healthy and enjoy the senses. That's the culture of the body. Right? Then above that is the culture of the mind. These are our
colleges and universities and think tanks and so on, where people accept and reject ideas on the mental platform. They all have a certain, this is exactly what happens in the university. Intellectual fashions change, and with no more sense than the fashions in clothes. Everybody's doing one thing, and after a while they get tired of it and they do something else. You look at the history of philosophy in the West, it goes through this and that other thing. It's not that anything is ever refuted, it's just everybody gets sick of doing one thing and then they all decide to do something else. That's a description from a philosopher. So people play with ideas on the mental platform. Sometimes they like them, they play with them for a while, they get tired, they go on to something else. This is the culture of the mind. Then Prabhupada said the culture of intelligence is Bhagavad Gita. That's why it's very difficult for people who are on the mental platform to understand Bhagavad Gita, because you really have to come to the platform with intelligence. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, the buddhi is emphasized in buddhi yoga. So Bhagavad Gita is really about the cultivation or the formation of buddhi.
And it describes intelligence as the ability to discriminate between spirit and matter.
That's right. Yeah, he calls it the next door neighbor to the soul. Because the super soul is guiding. In the verse in the second chapter, that what is dark night to everybody is daylight for the sage who sees, and vice versa. Prabhupada said there are two kinds of intelligent men. One is intelligent for sense gratification, the other is intelligent for sense self-realization. He's using that term intelligence as buddhi. Your whole interest is in sense gratification, and therefore if your buddhi has put yourself in that way, no, Krishna consciousness, you can't see it. It just doesn't make sense. What do you do? But if your buddhi is on Krishna consciousness, then all the activities that people engage in sense gratification, there's nothing going on here. So that's buddhi. So when buddhi has been developed or properly, then what do? You surrender to Krishna. That's the end of the Bhagavad Gita, which he says is where the Bhagavad Gita ends, Bhagavatam begins. And Bhagavatam, he says, is the culture of the soul proper. Bhagavad Gita ends, Sarvadharmam Puritjaja Mamekam Sharanam Raja. Bhagavatam begins, Dharma Projita Kaitavo Atra Paramo. So what are those dharmas you're rejecting? No, that Krishna's talking of Sarvadharmam Puritjaja, any materially contaminated. So that he describes these different levels. I think that was a very nice description. So just because it evolves out of or is manifest out of the mode of passion doesn't mean it's exactly lower. And it only functions by through the mind. I mean, buddhi by itself is in connection with the mind. So it's the mind actually when it's purified that it's your best friend. It's described that way. Okay. Well, I guess we're past time, so we'll pick up tomorrow where we left off about some things about Shankarshan. And then we'll go through these prayers, and also we'll take a look at the 25th chapter a little bit too. Then the day after tomorrow is no class because it's Vaitacharya's appearance today. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.